headlines. Iran says it supports any initiative that leads to ceasefire and peace between Russia and Ukraine and is ready to play a role in ending the war. Kremlin says U.S. midterm elections will not have any significant impact on Moscow's ties with Washington, which are at a historic low. And a man shouting slogans against the British monarchy throws eggs at King Charles before being arrested by police officers in northern England. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says Tehran welcomes and supports any initiative based on dialogue that results in a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. Ali Shamkhani said that Iran is ready to play a role in ending the Ukraine war. He made the remarks after a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Nikolai Petrushev, in Tehran. According to Russian media reports, the meeting revolved around the situation in Ukraine, as well as Western interference in the internal affairs of both countries. Shamkhani and Petrushev discussed the measures to counter such interference. They also talked about the importance of boosting deeper Tehran-Moscow ties in energy, transportation, agriculture, trade, and banking sectors. The visiting Russian official also met with President Ebrahim Raisi and discussed bilateral and regional issues. Iran warns the UK of consequences over its attempts to destabilize the Islamic Republic during recent riots across the country. Intelligence Minister Ismail Khatib said that unlike the UK, Iran will never support terrorist acts in other countries. But at the same time, he added that Iran will have no obligation to prevent the emergence of insecurity in those countries. Therefore, the minister said the UK will pay for its actions to make Iran insecure. Khatib spoke about the London-based Persian-language TV network Iran International. He said that Tehran has declared the channel a terrorist organization, whose agents will be prosecuted by the intelligence ministry. Khatib said that Saudi Arabia and Israel were also involved in actions supporting the riots in Iran. Unrest broke out following the death of young woman Mahsa Amini. Turning now to the occupied Palestinian territories, where Israeli atrocities show no signs of abating, the regime forces have killed yet another Palestinian man in the West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, the man, identified as 29-year-old Rafat Ali Abdullah, was fatally shot in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. The Israeli regime has not commented on the latest killing by its forces. Hours before, the regime's forces killed a Palestinian teen during a raid on a refugee camp in Nablus. Israel has recently intensified its deadly crackdown on Palestinians across the occupied territories. More than 140 people have been killed in the West Bank this year alone.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank areas continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mehdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others. Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph Stump, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts. Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Moving now to the U.S. midterm election, the future of Congress hangs in balance as it is still unclear whether Democrats will be able to keep their majority in both the Senate and the House. No party is currently holding the lead in the Senate. There are 100 seats up for grabs, and people are waiting on the fate of only four of them. In the U.S. House, Republicans have been able to secure more seats than Democrats. Despite many votes having yet to come in, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy says that it is clear the Republicans will take control of the House. There are 435 seats up for grabs in that chamber. A shift in power in Congress would make Democratic President Joe Biden a lame duck for his remaining 2 years in office. Colin Campbell joined us earlier for an update. He explained how Americans feel about the outcome of the elections.
So in Washington right now, a lot of people are anxious about the outcome of this election. You had a president who came in thinking that he had a mandate to build America better, fix infrastructure, deal with some of the racial inequities here, deal with some of the issues dealing with some of the more marginalized communities across the country. You also had to deal with the abortion issue, which became an issue during his presidency when the Supreme Court overturned the Roe versus Wade ruling, something that was established in the early 70s. So now you have people on the president's political side, Democrats, saying we have to show up at the polls. At the same time, though, historically, whatever party is in power usually suffers some type of losses during the midterm elections. This was supposed to be augmented, especially during Biden's time in office, because he's not a very popular president. He has a low approval rating. Congress has a low approval rating. So there was expected to be a lot of Republicans just wiping out Democrats, and therefore it would be a huge loss for Biden and his political allies. What we're looking at, however, is a divided Congress if everything that is occurring now holds true when the final votes come in. This will make it extremely difficult for the president to pass any cogent policy alluding to anything that he had promised on the campaign trail.
Russia says its ties with Washington will remain at rock bottom, regardless of the outcome of the U.S. midterm elections. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described the existing relations with the U.S. as bad and said the elections would not have any significant impact. Moscow's relations with Washington are currently at a historic low over the conflict in Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly slammed the White House for providing Kyiv with weapons and financial support, a move that could be constrained if Republicans take control of Congress. The U.S. has committed multiple security packages to Ukraine and slapped numerous sanctions on Russia since the beginning of the war in February. Earlier this week, Kyiv urged Washington to remain united until there was peace in Ukraine. German journalist Alina Lipp is facing 3 years in prison in her home country for her coverage of crimes committed by Ukrainian forces against civilians. As our correspondent Johnny Miller finds out, German authorities are also persecuting Alina's mother simply for being her mother.
This is Petra Bass Lipp. She is the mother of Alina Lipp, a journalist whom the German government is trying to imprison due to her reporting in Donbass. Like her daughter, she has fled Germany to Crimea due to persecution. The government recently arbitrarily closed her bank account.
First her bank account, then her father's bank account, and last mine. So, yeah.
And what does that do, closing down your bank account?
What does it? You must imagine, you can't buy your food anymore, you can't pay your rent, you can't pay your insurance, you can pay nothing from one moment to the other. So, what to do?
And the German, there was no legal decision over this, there was no court case, they didn't even tell you, they just shut it down?
No, they didn't tell me. No, nothing.
How did you survive?
I'm a creative person. I had some money, of course. I'm lucky, some cash. And they told me I can go to the church and to tell my story.
So the state told you that? The state told you go to the church?
No, my bank officer told me that. Because I asked him, what shall I do now? And he told me, oh, maybe you can go to the church.
The German government is still attempting to imprison Alina Lipp for her work in Donbass. Now, I've seen the court documents, and the reasons they give are that Alina has reported that Ukraine has been killing its own people in Donbass for 8 years, and that the majority of people there support Russia. Now, these are two undeniable facts. Perhaps the most worrying aspect of this case is that her court order effectively criminalizes honest reporting in Ukraine. Because if you're a journalist, mainstream or otherwise, or a political figure, and you want to point out these two very important facts, you risk going to jail, raising questions about Germany's ability to make sensible policies on Ukraine.
As they see the, Elena as an enemy of their narrative, her message as a threat, they want to make Elena's move impossible by blocking the financial capability and creating a psychological pressure. They are distorting her focus out from the things what she were doing before, and I mean seeking the truth and telling the truth to the German audience, and that is their target. And when they are succeeding of disturbing her job, then they think that they are winning the battle.
Yes, I think that the governments in Europe, because I'm not the only case, prosecute the parents of journalists, because we, of course, get support of our parents. They support us. Maybe also it's the fact that if they close my bank account, probably the parents will help out. For me, it's an act of a suppressive state, or even terror state. I don't know what's going on in Germany now.
While WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange languishes in a British jail, and French journalist Adrien Bouquet recently survived an assassination attempt in Turkey, he suspects, by the Ukrainian SBU, for Alina and her mother, it's exile. The threat to Western journalists who challenge the mainstream with uncomfortable truths is growing. Johnny Miller, Crimea.
Anger at the British Memorial. A man throws eggs at newly enthroned King Charles III during his visit to the city of York in northern England. Footage appeared to show four eggs narrowly missing the king and landing on the road next to him. The incident happened as Charles was entering the city along with Camilla, Queen Consort, and other dignitaries. Before his detention, the man was heard shouting, quote, "This country was built on the blood of slaves." Media have identified him as a member of the Green Party who stood in local elections. Charles ascended to the throne in September after the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth. His succession renewed focus on lavish and extravagant lifestyle of the British royal at a time when ordinary Britons are struggling with the cost of living crisis. The Greek capital has witnessed clashes between police and protesters demanding higher wages to keep pace with spiraling inflation. Protesters outside of Parliament in Athens threw stones and petrol bombs at police during the scuffles. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd and detained 10 protesters. They estimated that around 20,000 people took part in the march to Parliament. The demonstration marks a 24-hour general strike over pay. Government has come up with a 5 billion euro aid package to help vulnerable citizens, but workers' unions say it does not suffice, calling for an increase in wages. Greece has been grappling with soaring prices over the last 6 months, with inflation peaking at 12% in September. Tensions are growing between Paris and Rome over Italy's decision to refuse a charity ship carrying more than 200 migrants to dock in its ports. The Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani says his country's new tough line on migrants is a signal to other EU members that they must play their part. Rome says it wants to reach an agreement on how to relocate migrants to various countries. Tajani has highlighted France's offer of a port of safety for one rescue ship as proof of the strategy is working. France, however, is critical of Italy's decision, calling the move unacceptable. France argues that Italy is taking a selective approach toward receiving migrants. A total of four charity ships carrying around 1,000 migrants have been stuck off Italy in recent days, with the government urging Germany and Norway to take charge of them. Life in Pakistan's major cities has been paralyzed as supporters of the former prime minister have held protests against the assassination attempt on Imran Khan. Nasser Kazmi has more to tell us in this report from Islamabad.
Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan blocked the key avenues and roads leading towards country's capital Islamabad, causing massive traffic jams, halting logistics, and forcing schools and offices to close. Khan, who is demanding immediate elections, survived the assassination attempt last Thursday in the eastern Punjab province, leaving him wounded along with his several party workers. Police have arrested the suspected shooter and registered a case against him. However, Imran Khan and his supporters are not satisfied with it, demanding that Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a senior military official be investigated through a UN inquiry for their alleged involvement in the attack. The masses on the streets were urged due to the violent protest and road closures, asking authorities to end what they call the ongoing drama.
We are sick of such protest and unrest. Our lives and properties are not safe. Political parties should resolve their issues in the parliament instead of disturbing our lives on the streets.
While apologizing the masses over the current political uncertainty in the country, the government asked the PTI-led provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces to play their role in opening the roads to ease the life of the masses.
I apologize to the people affected by Imran Khan's long march and protests on behalf of the federal government. We strongly requested the provincial governments to open the national highways immediately.
Khan's party has announced that its anti-government march will be resumed on Thursday at the place where Khan was attacked.
The recent attack on former Pakistani Prime Minister has deepened the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Among European countries that are accepting immigrants and war refugees, the United Kingdom has accepted the fewest of all. And, according to human rights groups, the conditions of immigrants and refugees in British camps are not favourable at all, and even their lives are at risk. Recently, British officials signed an agreement with Rwanda to transfer immigrants to this African country instead of settling them in Britain. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has more for us. Recently, Britain's interior minister defended the government's treatment of newly arrived migrants after critics blamed her for the wretched conditions endured by thousands of people at the overcrowded centre for asylum seekers. Hundreds of people who crossed the English Channel in small boats have been moved to Manston in Kent, a former airfield in southeast England, after another processing centre was hit with gasoline bombs on Sunday, 30th of October, by an attacker who then killed himself. There already were 3,000 people at this facility, which is intended to hold about half that number. Lucy Morton, who heads the Immigration Services Union, said the number of people at Manston had reached 4,000 and it was catastrophically overcrowded. Britain's Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, defended her department's behaviour, claiming officials were working tirelessly to improve facilities for asylum seekers. But the right-wing politician also referred to small boat crossings as the invasion of our southern coast and said illegal immigration is out of control. Manston in Kent is supposed to be a temporary processing centre where new arrivals spend 24 hours before moving on to longer-term accommodation. But refugee groups say some people have been stuck at this facility for weeks. Chief Inspector of Borders, David Neal, who recently visited Manston, said recently that conditions were wretched. He told lawmakers there had been cases of diphtheria and it's really dangerous situation. Home Secretary Suella Braverman, who has been in the job for a matter of weeks, is a contentious figure, already under pressure for her use of insecure private email. Her hardline approach has sparked criticism from within the governing Conservative Party, as well as from the opposition. Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale, who represents the Manston area in Parliament, said the situation there was a breach of humane conditions. He accused Braverman of deliberately worsening conditions at Manston by refusing to book hotel rooms for asylum seekers. Suella Braverman denied she had prevented migrants from being moved to hotels. The website of ABC News has more for us. Thousands of refugees, including children, are being held in prison-like conditions at a refugee detention centre in England, and that has drawn concerns about the British government's treatment of asylum seekers. About 1,600 migrants who arrived on British shores after crossing the Channel in small boats are being held in a centre located at the site of a former British Air Force base in a village in Kent in southeast England. Up to 4,000 refugees were staying there at one point recently, with some reportedly detained unlawfully for a month or even more. The overcrowding at the centre reached a breaking point these days after hundreds of people were moved there from another migrant processing centre nearby that was hit with petrol bombs. According to independent government inspectors, families are sleeping on floors in dangerously overcrowded conditions that presented fire and health hazards. They warned of the risk of outbreaks of cases of scabies, diphtheria and other conditions were reported. The conditions at the centre in the village of Manston has put a spotlight on wider problems in Britain's asylum system. Critics say London's incompetence in managing the system goes beyond Manston. The opposition Labour Party has said only 4% of asylum claims from small boat arrivals were processed last year, meaning more than 100,000 people are in limbo, waiting for their applications for protection to be considered. Critics, including Labour, have blamed Britain's Home Secretary Suella Braverman's hardline stance against unauthorised immigration for aggravating the problems within the asylum system. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said the migrant crisis is a serious and escalating problem. Rishi Sunak acknowledged that not enough asylum claims are being processed, but claimed his Conservative government was getting a grip on the situation. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more for us. UK police have confirmed a man threw petrol bombs attached with fireworks at a new Border Force immigration centre in Dover, in Kent, adding the suspect was found deceased nearby. The attacker, a white man in blue and white shirt, drove up to the centre in a white sports utility vehicle. According to a photographer for the Reuters news agency, he threw three petrol bombs, one of which did not go off. Police said the suspect was identified and located at a nearby petrol station, where he was confirmed dead. One minor injury was reported in the incident. A photograph of the incident showed a man releasing a plastic bottle taped to a lit firework as he drove away. Police added the suspected attacker had been identified and located, confirming reports that the suspect had died while saying inquiries were ongoing. The apparent attack occurred at an immigration centre compound on the Dover Harbour side in Kent. The compound is where people who have crossed the channel in small boats are taken by Border Force officials. It came after almost 1,000 people arrived in the United Kingdom after crossing the channel on Saturday, 29th of October. The incident has prompted a call for politicians to stop using anti-immigration rhetoric. Claire Mosley, the founder of the campaign Care for Calais, said she was concerned recent rhetoric by ministers may have been a factor in the attack. Claire Mosley said, "We're seeing an escalation in hate on social media and threats against our volunteers. The rhetoric from this government's ministers is shocking and divisive."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. We've been looking at the components of an Islamic identity, starting off with understanding what the I is inside of me, traveling towards the power of thoughts. And yesterday we talked about the fact that the Islamic identity is a mind, body, and soul reality. And my entire purpose last night was this idea that we cannot simply ignore those that dimension of the deen that does ask us to live a physically enabled life, meaning that how we dress and what we wear and what we eat and how we live a physical life in this world is all part and parcel of this identity. And we move on from this discussion on the components of the identity, and today and tomorrow, maybe even the next day, we look at the barriers. Theoretically, it sounds great. Right? On paper now, for the past six lectures, it's all kind of been theory. But on the ground, and a lot of my parents can attest to that, who have younger kids now, entering those teenage years now, and trying to kind of inject this Islamic pride inside of them is a challenge. There's fear, a little bit of anxiety. There's a lot of worry now. And as a father of three, I'm with you as well. My eldest being 13, my youngest being 6. It's a challenge. And to my young guys who are right now listening to me, late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, it's one thing that I want to mention right off the bat in the beginning, and there might be a lot of you right now who are on the fence, who perhaps maybe don't believe you have all the tools, the courage, to be able to do what I'm asking myself and all of you to do, and that is to really bring home a solid, strong Islamic identity. Let me take you through a little bit of history in the beginning Inshallah, we'll get to the first barrier on this path. I have an immense affinity towards young people. I'm inspired by them. I find that individuals who are fighting the fight on the ground today to be incredible. Sometimes they'll slip, sometimes they'll fall, sometimes they'll have days and weeks where they're confused. But this dismissal sometimes that we have as a community, as a generation of today's youth, as I mentioned before, Maghrib in Pickering, the idea that, you know, the entire generation is a waste now, these guys are useless, blah, blah, blah. I don't share in that discussion. Because it's my phone that blows up, right? It's the talks I have with a 16-year-old who's trying to understand God. And to the point where, you know, on the other side of the phone now, there's tears that I want to believe in God, but it just doesn't make sense to me. This portion, that dimension, this discussion. And this fight that they're fighting is that they want to avoid inheriting the religion from mom and dad. They're tired of praying because dad says so. They're tired of coming to the mosque because they're dragged here. It has to come from within, and they want it to come within, but sometimes they're bound by their own principles. This blind faith that they refer to, that doesn't sit well with them. And we know from history that once a young person accepts the truth, that's it. They will work very hard now to preserve that truth. Again, I mentioned this a couple of nights ago. To me, the most powerful stories in the Quran is that of Nabi Musa. His entire story is filled with lessons that apply, I think, to us today. To me, one of the most powerful scenes from the story of Nabi Musa is probably his most famous moment, where he defeats the magicians of Fir'aun. These vetted magicians that he searched Egypt up and down, very confidently now, to bring down Musa, alayhi salam. As you know, didn't happen. Nabi Musa now defeated them in front of all of Egypt. That's not the point that gets me. The point that gets me is that when they were able to see the reality and the truth, nothing mattered at that moment. It's incredible. Here they were, the people of Egypt, that were frightened by Fir'aun, were controlled by Fir'aun. This is a man who not only would control everything about them to the point where he would even dictate to them who to worship. If you want to worship somebody, if you want to see who's worthy of worship, there's nobody better than me, Fir'aun would say. So something as private as worship even, he would hijack, oppress them, rule them using fear. And so any sort of even a glance towards Fir'aun, nobody would do it. And here you have the biggest day of the year in Egypt, the day where everyone comes out, watching this unfold. These seven, I believe, the hadith says, magicians, saw what they saw, on the spot with Fir'aun sitting on his throne in front of his own people, saying that we now believe in the Rabb of Musa. That's not even the part that gets me. The part that gets me is that Fir'aun becomes livid. He just loses himself. Imagine now the embarrassment. He was convinced, the way he even attended that event, his throne was draped in jewels and diamonds. He himself was draped from head to toe. This was a man who was about to celebrate his biggest defeat of Musa. And it didn't work out like that. He was a favorite. Supposed to sweep Musa in four games. Didn't happen. Instead, the underdog won. And his anger now, to the point where the Quran captures this, says, look, I'm going to torture you. And the way that, and I don't mean to be, you know, graphic, but the way that Fir'aun would torture individuals sometimes, cut one limb of one side and the other limb of the other side. right arm, left leg. Left arm, right leg. Tie him to a tree, the trunk of a tree, let them bleed out. That's cruelty. And when they were threatened with that, it didn't shake them. You do whatever you want to us, they would say. To who? To Fir'aun. But you can't make us unsee what we saw. You can't take the belief away from us. No longer are we ignorant. Are we ghafil? Are we heedless? Now we know. And once we know, we can't unknow. These were young individuals. And I see a dimension of that in today's youth as well. They're not all is lost. Yes, I know there is concern. And there should be, but there was always concern. When I was growing up in this city, 14, 15, oh, there's lots of concern back then. We should never be not concerned. We'll let our guard go down. But when you look at historically, very quickly in the beginning of tonight's lecture, when you look at historically, you look at three major events in Islamic history. One, of course, was the establishment of Islam by the Prophet of Allah in Mecca and Medina. One, of course, was this commemoration, the days of Ashura. And one will be the arrival of our Imam. And the one common denominator in all three of them are the young. The Prophet of Allah would give very difficult responsibilities to young people. And back then, and it still kind of holds true today, back then the culture was, if you were older, a little bit of whiteness in your beard, you were wiser. If you were younger, you were a little bit foolish. And you couldn't be trusted. Right? So the known sort of custom was that if you need something done properly, you have to ask the elders.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
The idea that the U.S. democracy is increasingly broken was evidently seen in midterms.
Based on an analysis of Federal Election Commission, 465 American billionaires have pumped over $881 million into federal midterm races, with the top 20 donor households giving 73% of the contributions, or collectively more than $643 million. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, in the U.S., people are often told that the next election is the most important of their lifetimes, or that they should vote like your life depends on it, because it does. Days away from the next midterm elections in the U.S., this month's polls show that motivation to turn out is relatively high among both Democratic and Republican voters, as both sets of party leaders amp up the divisive rhetoric and claim that the opposition has a radically different vision for the nation. Their lives are certainly impacted by and, dare to say, endangered by American policy. Sadly, the state of affairs with what they euphemistically call American democracy means that they, as Americans, simply cannot save themselves through elections. If the goal of American elections is to fulfill democracy, then American elections are dysfunctional. A 2014 study published by Cambridge University Press already classified the U.S. as closer to an oligarchy than to a democracy, saying average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence in American policymaking. Indeed, the gap between the policies Americans say they want when polled and the policies enacted by their elected representatives widens with each generation. Donald Trump campaigned in 2016 on a promise that he would end American wars, but once in office, continued their imperial violence. Less than 2 years ago, Democrats got behind John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock in Georgia Senate races and promised that Americans helped elect the two and gave Democrats control of the U.S. Senate. They would cut $2,000 COVID relief checks. The nation pitched in. Campaign contributions from all over the nation poured into Georgia on behalf of the Democratic candidates, and the pair were elected. Nearly 2 years later, the main campaign promise, $2,000 COVID relief from Democrats, is still unfulfilled. Both parties' campaign promise specific things if they elect them and when they get elected and place in sufficient power to deliver on those promises, they simply refuse to do so. Now, they are being asked to give them more power and told that really this time they will give Americans what they promised. They didn't do it in 2021 with the COVID relief checks. Neither party seems very worried about disappointing their base to the point where they get rejected and lose elections. In this venture, capital-styled political system, raising private capital is more essential to the life of a politician or party than winning elections. American voters are being lied to as boldly as ever by politicians, while the opposite of their interest are being pursued by them once in office. The U.S. proxy war against Russia in Ukraine is just the latest and perhaps the most dangerous example. A clear majority of polled Americans say they want the U.S. to pursue direct peace negotiations with Russia. Despite this, both Democrats and Republicans are voting uniformly to give billions more to weapons makers to fuel the violence in Ukraine. And the Biden administration's top diplomat's official policy has been pointedly and proudly not to speak with his Russian counterparts. Americans want their government to negotiate peace, and all the latter has done thus far is help dissuade peace negotiations. If only the lone problem with American elections were that they situated politicians in power who refuse to implement policies voters want. Alas, their elections are more fundamentally fraught than that. Democrats say baselessly that Republicans are under Russian control. Republicans say, without evidence, that Democrats are stealing election victories. Meanwhile, people of color continue to get thrown off voter rolls. They have no national uniformity with voting procedures, which means, among other things, some Americans only have to cross the street to cast a quick vote on election day, while others have to drive miles past police barricades and wait in lines at poorly operating polling centers. U.S. general presidential elections are literally undemocratic because U.S. votes don't count legally. Only those of the several hundred members of their electoral college do. If democracy is the point of American politics is dysfunctional. Democracy is not lucrative, however. Don't be surprised if members of both major parties decide not to include the voters' desires in next year's plans. The money continues to pour into members of both parties, and the big donors contributing to those coffers will continue to wield much more influence over American politics than any non-wealthy voters. In this regard, the website of Truth Out noted, in the current political landscape, fascism is on the rise, and the threat to democracy is imperiled both as an ideal and promise. A number of politicians running for a variety of political offices believe in conspiracy theories, embrace elements of white supremacy, are election deniers, and argue for white Christian nationalism and policies that endorse voter suppression and the banning of books, among other repressive measures. All of these positions should be understood as toxic elements of a rhetoric fueling the neo-fascism embraced by most of the Republican Party, a rhetoric of historical erasure, hate, bigotry, and a politics of disposability. Fascism in the United States is no longer a spiraling improbability, while President Biden claimed in a recent speech that the coming election puts democracy on the block, he vastly underestimates the degree to which the resurgent right wing could soon usher in a fascist politics in the United States. What must not be forgotten is that the politicians advocating these anti-democratic authoritarian positions are not rogue deviants. Rather, they are symptoms of a much wider culture of fascism that condones and normalizes their bigotry and encouragement of violence. They are the new face of a fascist politics. Hunting the U.S. fascist rhetoric is no longer underground in the U.S. It has been awakened and is embraced without apology with the emergence of a new form of brutality. This is a brutality that basks in the language of demagogues, encourages those who trade in lies and ignorance, and manipulate public opinion in the service of tyrants and violence. This rebranded form of fascist politics and its advocates in the coming election share the collapse of conscience reinforced by a form of historical erasure that forgets that their language echoes a history that led to genocide, massive deaths, and assaults on human dignity. This rhetoric exceeds and targets more than any one specific group. It goes far beyond. This rhetoric is now part of a broader language of disposability aimed at migrants, people of color, refugees, and others. What should be condemned here is not only their actions, but also a society that has allowed this fascism to become once again normalized. What should be understood and interrogated in the age of rebranded fascism is the broad-based attack by anti-democratic forces in the Republican Party and their allies on those critical political, cultural, and social institutions that attempt to create informative and critically engaged citizens. The sinister nightmare of a fascist takeover no longer resides in the works of dystopian fiction. It is here in the present, functioning as a lethal fairy tale defined by a contempt for democracy and heralding political doom. The threat of fascism is no longer a matter of speculation. It is about to be put to vote in an election that could transport the unthinkable form, being a provocative fiction, to a cruelly excruciating reality.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. Now, Imam Zainul Abidin wants to defend the following thesis, that humbling oneself before Allah, weeping to Allah, worshipping and supplicating to Allah is to polish the soul, to make oneself more determined, to make oneself more reliant on Allah, and not to slacken. He wants to defend this thesis, but this Shia layperson also has an erroneous understanding that he wants to correct. What would you say? Look at the Imam's words. Let us not speak of my father, my mother, and my grandfather. Paradise is for the obedient. This is the thesis of Shia Islam with regard to faith and actions. Why am I placing so much emphasis on this issue? Because for many years, centuries even, the idea has been put into the minds of Muslims that it is not necessary to do anything in order to be a Muslim. They have been told that all you need to be a believer is a pure heart. You don't need to do anything else. And we have helped our enemies foster this idea in our minds through our own indolence and laziness.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We think that we are going to paradise and it will be given to us for the slightest thing. This false notion has been so successful in spreading because people are ignorant and they want to believe this is true. They had no other motive in spreading this idea save that they were ignorant. In fact, it was only a short time after the Prophet that this idea came into existence and began to spread. In the early centuries of Islam, one day people saw that Muawiyah was advising his followers that when he died, there were two packages that they should bring and bury with him in his grave. They asked, "What are these things?" He tells them that one of the packages contains a piece of the Prophet's clothes. As for the other, well, one day the Prophet was trimming his hair or nails, and some clippings fell on the ground, which Muawiyah said to his followers, "Put these in my grave so that Allah forgives me." Do you see? Even Muawiyah hoped for the Prophet's intercession and tried to obtain it. But how did he do this? By taking some hair or nail clippings from the Prophet. Bravo! He was willing to strive to the extent that it was easy, to the extent that it was no cost to him. He will listen to the Quran, he will respect the Quran, but only to the extent that it is useful for him.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.